In 1954, the Supreme Court declared separate schools for black and white students inherently unequal and therefore a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Brown versus Board of Education was a turning point in the civil rights movement, and its impact went far beyond schools. For the next two decades, the ruling fueled a legislative revolution. New laws guaranteed equal access to jobs, travel, voting, public accommodations, and housing.
But while legal segregation is a thing of the past, racial separation persists in schools and even more so in the communities where people live. That's the conclusion Cheryl Cashin drew after studying data on school enrollment and census tracts. Cashin is a Georgetown University law professor and a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. She's also the author of a new book called The Failures of Integration: How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream. She argues that these days, segregation is often by choice, a choice that involves finding a neighborhood that offers strong schools and safe streets.
Well, the reality is that most of us, if you look at who we share our life space with, we tend to live in neighborhoods where the people around us look like us racially and are in our same economic class. And in terms of who we spend intimate time with on a day-to-day basis, most of us are spending time with people who look like us and are in the same class. So we haven't yet made that beautiful vision that animated Brown true for people.
You lay out in the book a series of assumptions that the middle class pursues or embraces to mm-hmm. achieve a certain standard of mm-hmm. living. And mm-hmm. I'd like you to sort of tick through those if you could.
Well, when a person contemplates moving to the suburbs and buying a home, I say in the book that they make a series of assumptions, and here are five assumptions that I list in the book. First, I can escape neighborhoods of poverty, particularly black ones. Second, my children will be able to attend good public schools. They will be prepared, maybe even well prepared, for college. Third, my neighborhood will be free from crime. Fourth, my property taxes will be manageable and I will receive better government services at lower costs than I would in the city. And finally, fifth, I will be able to buy all the things I want and need at stores that are located near where I live. And what I say in the book, and this is a painful conclusion for me as an African American myself, that these assumptions do not tend to maintain for black neighborhoods. And in fact, I come to the conclusion that it's only a relatively small fraction of the American population that lives in metropolitan regions that are achieving this sort of mythic American dream.
So if black middle-class families, mm-hmm. you know, applied these five questions mm-hmm. that they tried to answer and mm-hmm. trying to find or achieve a certain standard of living.
Right.
Is the outcome the same if they choose to live in an integrated neighborhood than if they choose to live in a segregated or a racially isolated mm-hmm. middle-class community mm-hmm. like Shaker Heights, Ohio, or Prince George's, Maryland, or Evanston, Illinois?
Right. Well, this is what I call the black middle-class dilemma. The only way a black person, or frankly any person in America, can confidently achieve these five assumptions, confidently, is to move into an area that is overwhelmingly white and affluent. For black people, what tends to happen in real estate markets is once you get a critical mass of black people, white people flee, and that depresses property values in the neighborhood, and then the next lowest rung on the income ladder of black people comes in to try to take advantage of the depressed housing markets. And so within a decade, the, you know, affluent or middle class or upper middle class black people who sought to create a suburban enclave find that the social distress that they thought they were escaping has migrated right up to them.
And is that one of the ironies of integration also, that in opening the fair housing laws allowed black families with a certain amount of wealth to move into areas beyond those that they were confined in? And in doing so, they leave behind a class. There's a certain kind of bright flight that occurs,
right.
And so the center city or the neighborhoods that they were once confined to suffer in some way.
Yeah, I mean, here's the real irony. In the Jim Crow era, black people of all classes depended upon each other and black people with choices couldn't escape. So you had, you know, the black professionals living right there among lower income people. And, you know, my father will tell me that in his high school that he went to, his teachers had PhDs and he had a perfectly good education. But now, in a post-civil rights world, affluent black people have choices. And although there you can find enclaves like Prince George's County outside of Washington where you have a high concentration of black professionals and affluent people, a lot of those people are bypassing the public institutions.
They send their children to private schools.
They send their children to private school. So, you know, the ironies abound for the black middle class in a post-civil rights world.
But there's a conundrum here that, mm-hmm. that I'm trying to understand.
Right.
So you come to the conclusion that the only way for a person of color to approximate the suburban ideal is to live in a community that is both overwhelmingly white mm-hmm. and relatively affluent. But you also say that their very presence will start to change the equation in that neighborhood, because as more blacks move into the neighborhood, more whites will move out of the neighborhood. So how do you ever achieve some degree of stable integration?
Right. There are some neighborhoods that buck this dominant trend of separation. You have neighborhoods, some neighborhoods in America, where you have not two races, but three or four. And something seems to happen when you interject a third race into this sort of tortured black-white dynamic, and often that third race is a Latino. When no one race is dominant, it seems to expand everyone's comfort level. And we have examples in Southeast Seattle, Mount Pleasant in the D.C. area, Jackson Heights and Queens, these communities where you have typically an influx of immigrants, but a lot of social comfort and dexterity. And you also what tends to happen in integrated communities is you have a variety of housing stock. So you have class integration as well as race integration, and you have a lot of civic organizations that are working on community values, cultivating community, and bridging across difference.
If the interjection of a third race mm-hmm. beyond the sort of the black-white divide mm-hmm. seems to lead to a more stable environment mm-hmm. in terms of integration, as someone who seems to believe in integration, mm-hmm. is that a hopeful sign for you, since America has such a fast-growing Latino population, a growing Asian population? Are we likely to see more stable, integrated neighborhoods as
a result?
Yeah,
this is the glimmer of hope I see in existing patterns and existing demographic trends. Sometime shortly after mid-century, we are going to be a majority-minority nation like California and Hawaii are today. And we could either cultivate a multicultural identity in America where all people embrace and celebrate difference and become comfortable living among it, or we could continue with the way of the bulwark and try to just completely separate and insulate ourselves from that exploding diversity. But I think we have no choice but to do the former.
Cheryl Cashin, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Cheryl Cashin is the author of The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream.
Cheryl Cashin argues that self-segregation also comes at a cost to middle-class white Americans. To read an excerpt from that portion of her book, you can visit our website, npr.org.